Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes. Nice
dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is James Freeman, originally from Melbourne, coming to you live from New York City. And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello, everybody, and thank you, James, for introducing the Tennis Podcast post-Queens, post-Halle, Berlin, Birmingham. And yes, they all had their finals at exactly the same time, because that's what tennis does at times like this. But that was an excellent intro. Thank you, James, from Melbourne via New York. Catherine is here. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, David.
Hello, Matt. How are you? Been on holiday?
Yes, I'm in my Casper Ruud grass court era, in that I'm not quite doing grass court tennis yet. I've been going to concerts, playing golf, doing all sorts of things. But I have brushed up on the week past in tennis and feel somewhat ready to contribute to this podcast.
Yeah, I would like to say I feel like you've done a lot more towards the grass court season than Casper Ruud has at this point. I mean, I get that Novak Djokovic can just put his feet up for 2.5 weeks and then pitch up and have a few days practice and be ready to try and win his, what, 8th title. But what is Casper Ruud thinking at the moment? are we okay with that? Can you just do that if you've reached the French Open final and accept that maybe you're unlikely to do that well on grass anyway? So,
who is less focused on tennis ahead of the grass court season, Casper Ruud or Stefanos Tsitsipas?
Yeah,
close one thing, I'd say.
Stefanos does seem to have a lot going on in his world. I do struggle to follow it at times, but and I have to say
David won't engage with Tsitsipas. It doesn't matter how much we thrust it to his attention in our WhatsApp group. David just sort of does an eye roll and tries to move the conversation along.
It's a bit like when you start talking about what's on the set list for the concert that you're not even going to, and I just start to glaze over. It's about the only thing I don't seem to partake in. And I'm pretty sure then conversations just depart onto another group that I'm not in.
Mm.
But
you'll never
okay.
know, David.
I don't want to be in it, so it's fine.
hang on, just to confirm before Matt's and my reputations are besmirched here, there is no separate Tsitsipas WhatsApp group.
No.
No.
Just Taylor Swift group.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, I was thinking, we didn't talk about how last week, the week before the one just gone, we all went to a concert in the same week. Different concerts.
We did, didn't we?
That's true. That would be quite a fun game
how
for Tennis
cool
Podcast listeners, actually. Guess who went to which concert?
Yes.
Very good. Very good.
Do we give them multiple choice and actually give them the three options or not?
Well, can you correctly assign who went to Harry Styles, who went to Bruce Springsteen, and who went to Pink?
Yes.
Yeah, I think, yes, our listeners can.
Okay. Probably. Although there's one that would maybe just get people wondering.
Hmm.
Oh. Okay. Excellent. Well, do write in, folks, and see if you can work it out. And the first one who gets it right, we will congratulate on the next Tennis Podcast. Okay, who'd have thought it would go in that direction, this tennis podcast? Well, I'm presenting it, so no massive surprise. Let's start where Catherine's been all week, at Queen's, where Carlos Alcaraz has won the title 6-4, 6-4 in the final, despite having nearly got knocked out in the first round. I mean, am I exaggerating there, Catherine? I mean, he seemed to be right on the cusp of defeat against, who was it again? He was at a late replacement,
Artur,
wasn't he?
Artur Rinderknecht, yeah, lucky loser who came in for another French Artur Fils, who, as we discussed on the last podcast, had qualified. We were super pumped ahead of Alcaraz Fils, and then on the morning of that match, poor old Artur Fils had to withdraw with a hamstring issue, I think, and it's prevented him from playing Wimbledon qualifying. I'm hopeful that he will get one of the last remaining wild cards. He wasn't in the original list. I think he'll be fit in a week's time, but he wasn't fit to play this week. So yeah, Artur Rinderknecht gets the call up, and of course he looks like a grass courter, doesn't he? Looks like he's been stretched out. Big serve, comfortable up at the net. Just a tricky customer for somebody finding their feet. Not someone you want to come up against first round when you're a bit, you know, like a freshly hatched giraffe. I have to say, I never quite felt like Alcaraz was going to lose that match. It always felt like one where he'd find a way. But then I probably would have said the same against old Fabian Marajan. Was that his name?
Yeah.
Fabian Marajan? That's a name that's definitely going to be in our end of year quiz, isn't it? And he ended up losing that one, so I could well have been wrong. But yeah, that was the closest he came to losing the entire week, it turned out. I think his best performance was against Grigor Dimitrov. No, his best performance was against Sebastian Korda in the semi-finals, although Korda was poor. So it was quite going into yesterday's final against Alex de Minaur, who's some grass courter, actually. So, better on grass than I had really realised ahead of this week. I think when I see that men have won Eastbourne titles, I always go, "Hi, well, yeah, but who really plays Eastbourne?" In the men's, I mean, the big guns don't play the week before a slam, do they? That's just not how it rolls. So I always kind of take that with a pinch of salt, but he's definitely beefed up his game, Alex de Minaur, and was a real revelation. So yeah, back to Carlos Alcaraz, it was quite difficult going into the final to know how well he was actually playing, because it had looked really good, but actually he'd had a few players consecutively put in quite disappointing performances against him. They were really playing the Carlos Alcaraz reputation, and unfortunately I'm looking at Grigor Dimitrov there in the quarterfinals, and well, I thought that was the case a little with Seb Korda in the semi-final, but it turned out he was carrying a bit of an injury, which honestly I'm almost relieved to hear that there is an explanation for his semi-final performance, because David, I was high on Seb Korda this week. I was believing the hype, I was all in, and he had been great. I'd picked him to win the tournament at the start of the week, and I felt really good about it, even though he was playing Carlos Alcaraz in the semi-finals. I think he was playing the best tennis of the week, and then he threw in an absolute stinker of a performance against Alcaraz. So I'm gutted for him that he's injured yet again. I don't know how serious it is, but I'm almost relieved.
I know what you mean. You want an explanation, don't you, in a situation like that, when you've seen him play that well? Because having not known that he was injured, I wondered whether this is a bit of a trait, a bit of a character flaw as a competitor in Seb Korda, because I've seen him do that before, play a level that makes me really think that he's going to be right up there and able to contend with all the very best players in the world when he beat Medvedev at the start of the year. But then, of course, he did have an injury that kept him out for several months. But I don't want the fundaments of his game to be less than I think that they are. That would be a real disappointment to me. I mean, obviously, I don't want him to be injured either, but at least that then makes some sense.
And I think those fundaments are, great word, by the way, more than they were in Australia when he was making that breakthrough against Daniil Medvedev, because in his own words, he's got a new body. He was determined to use that really ill-timed injury to his advantage, to use it as a positive. And he said, you know, it was tough, but I've come back with a completely new body. He employed Jez Green. He employed Mark Bender. He just went to the Andy Murray cast-offs bin. Said, get me some of that, please. And it's worked out. He's bigger, he's stronger, he's more consistent, I think. He just looks more secure because he's got that more solid foundation, and he looks mentally stronger because he obviously has this confidence in his body and in his endurance. I mean, maybe the fact that he's picked up this niggle will shake that newfound confidence. But the way he was talking last week after a second round victory at Queen's, can't even quite, against Francis Tiafoe, wasn't it? Which was a great win. Tiafoe, I think, a little bit on fumes from winning Stuttgart. But after a second round victory at Queen's, Seb Korda comes in the interview room and says, I'm a contender at Wimbledon.
He put himself in the mix.
It was, as I'm sure you can imagine, I loved that. And I believed it. I ran with it. I mean, I wasn't suddenly going, Korda's going to win Wimbledon. But I definitely felt like, this guy's different. He's got all the talent that we've known about for years, but there is something different going on here. And imagine my disappointment at how that semi-final unfolded. I thought it was going to be epic. And it absolutely was not. Yeah, Balgraz was very, very good. And it turns out, you know, as evidenced by the fact that he won the final against a very, very good Alex de Minaur, really was playing well on grass by the end of the week.
What do you think, Matt, about Alcaraz now? He's come into this tournament. I find it such an interesting little period of his career because he's had this fantastic year. He's got over the main injury he had. He's underlined all the things that we think about him. And then he's run into Djokovic and he's kind of frozen in this match. And Djokovic has caused it as well with his excellent play. I think he was brilliant on the day. But the aura of Djokovic got to Alcaraz. He was quite open about that, and he cramped, and he just capitulated in that match, which was shocking. Shocking to me, because I really didn't imagine that that would be something that would happen. He's bounced out of that. He sounded not particularly up on his chances after this first match win against Rinuccinesh, and then suddenly he gets a win that he is happy about. And he's like a different player. And he's not lost a set since. He looks totally at home on the grass. I mean, my feeling was it was like watching Nadal at Queen's in 08 when he beat Djokovic. And then he went and won Wimbledon. Now, he'd got some more reps under his belt. He'd already been to two Wimbledon finals by that point. But there was a feeling of, crikey, I can do this. This is great. But, I mean, what do you think about Carlos Alcaraz now, grass court player, Wimbledon around the corner? Where'd you put him in it all?
Well, I put him as the second favourite to win Wimbledon. I mean, I might have been there already before this week, to be honest, just because I think the gap between Djokovic and the rest of the field is so big at Wimbledon with his experience there. And generally, Alcaraz is better than everyone else in the world, and no one else really stands out as a grass court player. So I was probably already thinking that Alcaraz was second favourite at Wimbledon, but even more so now. I think you used a bit of a football term there, David, which I was going to use in terms of his sort of ability to bounce back. His bounce back ability, I think, is something that managers always talk about, and it's a trait that tennis players really do need, because, you know, most of the time you lose. Even the great players lose more tournaments than they win. And I'm really impressed with the way Alcaraz has responded from that defeat to Novak Djokovic, which I think would have been a real blow to him. He seems to have rediscovered the joy of playing tennis instantly once again. And it actually makes me think back to that quite sort of harrowing, chastening defeat he had at the end of, I think it was 2021, to Hugo Gaston.
Hugo Gaston?
In Paris, of course, because that's the only city in which Hugo Gaston can play tennis, apparently. And that was a thing at the time where we thought, gosh, that might affect Alcaraz in the future. You know, he sort of froze, the crowd got on top of him, he really didn't deal with it well. And then it's almost like that didn't happen, because he just came out the next season and was just fresh and brilliant, and we all know what he did last year. So I think that is a trait that Alcaraz has, and it's a really good one to have. And in terms of his grass court game, I mean, I think the movement is probably the one area where I still think he looks worse on grass compared to the other surfaces. You know, he can still get around the court incredibly well, it's just a little bit less natural, I suppose. But you realize that he's got so many elements to his game which are going to be great on grass. The way he can flatten out his backhand, I think, is really useful. That was particularly noticeable against Korda, I felt, when they were sort of trading backhands. Alcaraz felt pretty comfortable. He's got an ability to take the ball early on his forehand and cause damage with that shot, and he's very happy coming up to the net and finishing points there, and he can use his slice backhand if he's in a little bit of trouble as well. And so I think the game is set up for grass pretty well, and honestly, him winning this title is just yet another little element of just Alcaraz doing things so quickly. You know, I had a look, I think this was his third tournament on grass, wasn't it, after a couple of Wimbledons, and then he's won Queens. I mean, Federer won his 12th grass court tournament. That was the first time he won a tournament on grass. Djokovic was also 12, Murray was 10, and Nadal was 8. I mean, Alcaraz has won his third. I mean, you know, there are some differences, you know, in there. Nadal had also reached 2 Wimbledon finals before he won his first grass court tournament, you know, so like-for-like comparison, maybe not quite, you know, applicable here. But I think it just shows that he's going to be a great, great player on a grass court. I don't know whether he's ready to beat Novak Djokovic this year over 5 sets on grass. But maybe the French Open experience will help him. You know, he might go in, if he does play Djokovic, I don't think he would be favourite to beat Djokovic at Wimbledon. He might be able to play with a little bit less tension in his body than he had at Roland Garros. And I would love to see a still quite raw Carlos Alcaraz on grass go up against just a seasoned, experienced, all-time great in Novak Djokovic. So basically, that's a very long answer to say that I think Carlos Alcaraz is in a pretty great place going into Wimbledon.
Very good answer as well. I really enjoyed that, and I agree with you. I loved, as somebody who... We all worked for many years at the Queen's Club, me for 25 years. I loved seeing him with that trophy. I just felt it was a really special moment. But that trophy goes back decades, so many decades. And the place was packed. I mean, they had 10,000 people every single day. The crowds were absolutely extraordinary at that tournament this last week. And to see him engage with them the way he does, I mean... I was watching all of your coverage, Catherine, on Prime, and you would hold the chat with your fellow, with one of your pundits, Annabel Croft or Tim Hemman or Greg Rozetsky or Daniela Hantikova, whilst one of the others was waiting for Alcaraz to come off the court to do an interview live on your service. And it was taking 15 minutes because he was just signing and having selfies with anybody who wanted them, and the people just loved him. It's hard to know whether they loved him more or he loved it more. He just seemed so happy in that environment.
Yeah, and I spoke to another colleague, Marcus Buckland, who was at the Queen's Club last week doing Q&As with players in the hospitality areas, and you know, that's the prawn sandwich brigade, you know, that a lot of what they've paid a very, very steep price for is, you know, you get to be in the presence of players and you get to hear from them, you know, special guest. And he said during the ones that are scheduled for that happened during Alcaraz's matches, they were having to cancel because nobody was in the hospitality suites.
Wow.
Every single bum was on a seat. And that is just something different, isn't it? That is an extra level of electricity and magnetism beyond even other very exciting names in the game. There is just something else with Carlos Alcaraz. Mm. And I think it's, I mean, the tournament must just be so frigging delighted that he's won that trophy, because now he's going to want to come back, isn't he? He's not going to want to change a winning game, and to have him feel a loyalty and an association with that tournament at this stage of his career, you know, with a decade, maybe two ahead of him, is massive for the championships.
Yeah, no, I think it was big too. I also thought it was great to see an Australian in the final again. There were years where we had Leighton Hewitt winning that tournament, and he's so close to Alex de Minaur, he would have told de Minaur about that place. And you could see how much it meant to de Minaur to play that well. I mean, he beat Andy Murray really convincingly, and he beat Holger Rune pretty easily as well. I mean, he was excellent. And look, he came up against a guy who does what he does, but he's just better at it. He hits it harder. He runs just as fast, if not faster. And he was too much for him in the final. But I think that's encouraging for de Minaur. You know, he should expect to have his best Wimbledon yet, I think, off the back of this.
Absolutely, absolutely. Look, he's been a good grass courter for a while. He's won a title in Eastbourne. He's had good results. He'd been in a semi-final in Queens. He's had good results, but this looked different to me. He's beefed up his game for sure. I understand he changed his strings at the start of the season, the physical strings, not the tension. He knew that that was going to be a long-term or medium-term investment in his game, that it would initially make him worse, there'd be a period of adjustment, and I think he's been through that, he's weathered it, and he's coming out the other side, and he's now in the dividend, the payoff stage, and there definitely looks to be an extra few miles per hour on his ground strokes, on his serve. He's serving consistently in the 130s, which is not something I think of with Alex de Minaur, and hitting the spots as well. He's so good at staying low. Obviously he's incredibly quick. I don't think he's in the mix for Wimbledon. I think there remains a ceiling to his game, but I think he's pushed that ceiling up a little. And it's good to see. I'm happy for him. And he also said he was very much inspired by what his girlfriend, Katie Bolter, had done in Nottingham the week before. He said that had really helped with his self-belief and motivation. So a grass court power couple.
Mm. Just one final note.
Paola and Steph. Another grass court power couple.
Maybe they will be inspiration for Tsitsidosa, yeah.
One final note from Queens. Actually, such were the photos of Alcaraz with that trophy, that which is a giant silver trophy, that it ended up with him on the cover of many of the sports pages of the national newspapers here in the UK. But interesting to see that the actual headline used in the Telegraph was not one about him winning the tournament. It wasn't one about looking forward to Wimbledon. The headline reads, Alcaraz, yes, I will play in Saudi Arabia. Now, over the last couple of days, stories have been written about moves being made by Saudi Arabia to take a closer interest in tennis. And I mean, I think that has been an ongoing conversation, from what the reports say, between certainly the ATP's Andrea Gaudenzi, the chairman of the ATP, and I think conversations have been had certainly in the past with the WTA, I've heard about. There is, I think, suggestions. I don't know whether it's confirmed yet, but certainly suggestions that the next gen finals are going to be moving to Saudi Arabia. And I mean, this comes at a time when sport is not just receiving an influx of investment from Saudi Arabia, but is nigh on being taken over certain sports or certain parts of sports. I mean, this all sort of took off in the golf world when the LIV Tour came along as a rival to the PGA Tour, and a lot of players were encouraged and enticed to go across and join that tour and leave the PGA Tour. And suddenly that has now been overwhelmed by the two joining forces, or depending on who you believe, Saudi Arabia literally taking over the PGA Tour and investing and being called the exclusive investor for a period of time. There are massive Premier League soccer football stars that are being enticed to go over to Saudi Arabia from the Premier League and other European countries. And it does appear that this is on the cards, Catherine, for tennis. It's not a surprise to us. It's something we've talked about as a sort of hypothetical in the past, but expecting it to happen. And yeah, Alcaraz found himself asked about it in a press conference following Queens. Again, not a surprise given the stories that are around at the moment. And I don't think those questions end here.
Gosh, absolutely not. I've been bracing myself for this for a while. And given the recent news about the public investment fund in Saudi Arabia and the PGA forming a partnership, whatever you want to call it, that sets a template, I think, for the Saudi Arabian state to buy off portions of the sporting world in order to buy legitimacy in the wider world. This is sports washing, and it is it's a no-brainer that they would go for tennis. I mean, tennis's governance structure is an absolute mess. If I were the Saudi Arabian Public Investment Fund, I'd be looking around sports going, who's ripe for a takeover, a battle? And I would instantly look at tennis. And if tennis hasn't been, I mean, in my head, I was thinking, gosh, tennis needs to arm itself and prepare its defences for the potential Saudi assault. You know, I thought it would come via the back door, via some sort of collaboration with the PTPA, or I don't know, some sort of rival tour. It sounds, sadly, and maybe this is assisted by what's happened with the PGA, like it might be a far more legitimised attack through the front door of partnering with the governing bodies themselves, which is utterly demoralising and depressing. I think we all have thoughts and feelings and are preparing ourselves for having to talk about this a lot, and also having to judge how much to talk about it, because we know that people come to sport for relief and levity, but equally this stuff matters, and the relief and the levity is a lot of why sports washing works. So it's crap. It's really crap. But it's not surprising.
No, and it's not going to go away anytime soon, I don't think. You know, we had a little chat about this before we came on, and we're not going to do a huge deep dive right now, but I mean, it's going to be talked about on this show and far beyond in the weeks and months to come.
I just have one more issue-related thing, David, while we're on, you know, generalised crap.
Oh, yeah.
New section.
Just one more issue thrown up by Queens that I just wanted to highlight, which was it's June, it's Pride Month in the UK at the moment and in a lot of places around the world, and the Sinch Championships, the LTA, had Pride Day at the tournament on Thursday, and a lot of tournaments have Pride Day these days. The French Open had Pride Day, didn't they? There wasn't much that we could see anyway. There wasn't an awful lot of activation around that at the French Open. I saw a few signs on screens and all the rest of it. Look, it's better that they do it than not. I would like to see more done around it. But I was really impressed by how much Queens did around Pride Day. There was all of the stewards were wearing rainbow wristbands and rainbow paraphernalia. There were rainbow flags flying. It was really all in on it. It was very, very visible. And I thought that was really impressive. They were dishing out rainbow laces and rainbow wristbands and so on in the media centre for anybody that wanted them. So that's all really, really positive and great. But not a single player wore any Pride paraphernalia, not shoelaces, not wristbands. Now, I don't think they were, in fact, I know they weren't actively asked to. Not suggesting for a moment anybody refused to do that, but those wristbands and laces were available and nobody proactively opted to make a statement that needs to be made, because men's tennis has and continues to have a problem. It is not a safe space for gay players. The fact that there are no openly gay active male players and never has been is proof enough of that. Men's tennis has a problem, and if you're not actively working to solve that problem, then you're part of it. And this is not an attack on any individual player. It's a culture, and it was just disappointing. I mean, it was uplifting. There was lots of uplifting stuff about Pride Day, but that element of it was disappointing.
Yeah. Just on the subject of final subject of Queens, actually, just as a tangent, because Matt talked about we were talking about how the Alcaraz Rinderknecht match was going on, and I wasn't able to watch this, which is why I was asking you how close he came to defeat. And the reason I wasn't able to watch it is because we were at Wimbledon, Matt and me, that day, and we were there for a very, very good reason. And you may have already heard via our social media outlets or via our newsletter that we are going to be doing something a bit different at Wimbledon this year, starting just in a few days' time. We are going to be on site and we are going to be live from Wimbledon. We are going to be streaming the tennis podcast every single night on YouTube, on our YouTube channel, live from Wimbledon. You'll still be able to get your podcast, same as you always do. But if you want to watch us, if you want to watch us do it live, if you want to watch Catherine and me have the arguments that we edit out sometimes, we're not going to be able to do that, are we, Catherine? Maybe we just will. Maybe we just won't be able to help ourselves and they'll just happen anyway. I do hope so. Yeah, that'll all be happening. Overlooking Court 18, Matt and I were checking it out. Got a picnic table.
The big Wimbledon announcement coming in hot after the crap section.
Yeah. Saudi Arabia, Pride Day with no players doing anything. And, good news. anyway, yes. So the good news follows the crap news, folks, here on the Tennis Podcast. And, yeah, so our link to our YouTube channel is in our show notes. If you would like to sign up to that and just basically keep across our social media outlets, you'll know when we're going live. Basically, we're going to do a live show on draw day at 6 p.m. UK time. That's Friday of this week. Matt will be there from about 4 in the morning queuing up to get into the draw. Saturday is media day, where we do all the interviews with players. So we'll be reflecting and reacting to what we've seen and heard in a show that we reckon will probably be about 4:30 p.m. UK. But I'm keeping that a little bit vague just because I don't know when media day will start and end completely yet. We haven't had the full schedule. And then every single night we'll be live after the final singles match on courts, centre court and court number one. So what time that will be, who knows. My guess is around about 9 o'clock UK time every night, but depends how long all the matches go, of course. But we hope you will come along and watch us. And if you don't, you can listen to the podcast. But we're very excited, Catherine. And most of all, I think, you know, we've been speaking to Wimbledon for quite a while about this. I think more than anything, I'm just happy that Wimbledon want us to be us. They don't want to change us. They just want to have us there and doing our thing and helping us to do it. And I'm really, really chuffed.
Co-signed. Really, really chuffed. It's brilliant. It's very exciting. Live arguments.
Yeah, you'll be able to look at Matt feeling awkward whilst we...
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, I need to work on my face.
Oh, dear. We only had a couple during Roland Garros. Most of the time we get along famously, don't we, Catherine? We're still going 11 years on. More than 1,100 episodes. Come on, it's not that bad.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This edition of the Tennis Podcast is sponsored by Tennis Channel, and Tennis Channel Plus is the place to watch the French Open. They've got every court live, and you can watch on your phone or your smart TV, both in HD. Matt, this sounds like your kind of thing.
Yeah, there's nothing I like more than watching multiple courts with matches everywhere, dipping in to where there's the latest final set tiebreak or even the latest bit of aggro.
And David, don't worry, you can just watch your favourite court, Suzanne Lenglen, all day if you want. But whatever you choose, the French Open promises unforgettable moments and new chapters in tennis history.
Do you know, I think in a lot of ways, the French Open is now my favourite slam. It's the strategy of the clay court tennis, the way it challenges players, and particularly now with legends of the game up against a new generation of young players. I cannot wait.
Be there when it happens, with daily live coverage beginning on Monday, May the 20th. Subscribe to Tennis Channel Plus to stream daily coverage of Roland Garros. Use promo code TENNISPOD20 for 20% off your annual subscription.
Right, I think it's high time we went to Germany here on the Tennis Podcast, and we're going to start in Germany in Berlin, where Petra Kvitova ruined my day yesterday, because I had gone for Donna Vekic to win the title in the newsletter at the start of the week, and I thought I was going to win 340 points, Matt. In the end, I won 0 points because Petra Kvitova played out of her mind in the final. I mean, even if you only get a chance to see match point, take that chance, because Donna Vekic hit one of the best shots she could possibly hit off the back edge of the baseline, and Kvitova just took one backward step and swiped it down the line for a winner with a forehand. I mean, it was staggering how well she was striking the ball. And what is that, 31 titles now for her? I mean, what a career she's put together.
Mm, yeah, 31 titles, six on grass now. And I think I remember very distinctly having the conversation after she won in Miami, will this be the high point of her season? And I think we all sort of said probably, but do not count her out on the grass and at Wimbledon. And the thing with Petra Kvitova is we don't really know when she's going to play well. She doesn't really seem to know when she's going to play well. But the most likely time of year is grass court season. And she's continued to win big tournaments as her career has gone on the grass. She won Eastbourne last year as well. And the players she beat in Berlin all have some pretty serious grass court pedigree. You know, it was Caroline Garcia, Karolina Pliskova, Ekaterina Alexandrova, Donna Vekic. You know, these are players who, none of them reaching the second week at Wimbledon would surprise me. And Kvitova had to go through all of them in Berlin, and she did it extremely convincingly. And yeah, I mean, we were privy to some of Pam Shriver's thoughts as she was sort of coaching Donna Vekic remotely, and then she put it on Twitter as well. So I feel like we can say that, you know, Pam felt that Donna didn't really do too much wrong in that final, and it was just proof of how good of a grass court player that Petra Kvitova is and always has been. And I think Donna Vekic can be very pleased with her week. It's more proof of just the progress that she's made in the last 9 months or so, continually reaching the latter stages of big tournaments and threatening to win them. But she came up against a great, great grass court player playing brilliant tennis. And honestly, if Petra Kvitova plays like that, absolutely, there is nobody she can't beat at Wimbledon, I think. It's one of those where it's kind of down to her.
Predictions nightmare.
Totally.
So is she in the mix?
Definitely. She has to be.
Yeah, she's in the mix.
Absolutely.
She's 100% also in the mix to lose first round.
That's the problem.
Because it's whether she's on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I being on two tournaments in a row has not been a thing for Petra Kvitova. There's a part of my brain saying, oh God, she's done it this week. So that
well she is still in the draw for Wimbledon, but...
Oh really?
Mm.
Right.
I think Petra Kvitova has been the player that has cost me in the predictions more than any
yes.
other over the past 10 years.
I think
years.
So. My dad always says,
yeah.
Is David going to predict Kvitova to win?
I mean, maybe this time. And that wouldn't... I wouldn't laugh at you. I mean, at this stage, Elena Rybakina is just... withdrawn from Eastbourne, hasn't she? She's still yeah. troubled by this virus that caused her to withdraw from the French Open, which is really worrying that 3 weeks on, she's still not right ahead of her Wimbledon title defence. Petra Kvitova is in my mix.
I love
Would
it.
Not surprise me at all if she won Wimbledon without dropping a set.
Whoa.
Also wouldn't surprise me if she lost in the first round.
Yeah. Yeah, it's well. The all evidence would say that is an equally plausible scenario based on her record. But just in isolation, and I'm sure I said this during Miami, it's just really enjoyable to watch it, to watch her play like she can. Probably even more so on a grass court because her game is so perfectly suited. And she was nearly taken to a third set, and I actually think that tells you how well Donna Vekic is playing right now, because she had to deal with two matches in a day the day before when the rain was coming down, and she beat Maria Sakkari in one of those, which, you know, that's a good win. And I actually think she could have a run into week two, no problem. I don't see her winning the tournament, but I think she could absolutely get to a quarter final or maybe further. And again, draws and who you end up against, the type of player you end up against, a lot of this stuff matters. I mean, I think she's 5-1 down in the head-to-head against Kvitova, but there are other players that might be ranked higher that I would back Vekic to beat. So it's going to be really interesting to see what happens when those players get to Wimbledon, and it's only a few days away now, of course. Staying in Germany... Halle, which I think was celebrating its 30th year this year, wasn't it? 1993. I remember when Halle began. In 1993, I remember Andre Agassi, as the reigning Wimbledon champion, signing up to play in Halle as his comeback tournament from a major wrist problem. He'd got a terrible wrist injury. I think he'd missed the French Open, and I think he'd missed everything really for months. And he played in the first round of Halle. They paid him an absolute fortune to be there. And he played the home player, Karl-Uwe Stabe. Did you ever remember him?
I did some Champions Tour events with him. Turns out that I was today years old when I learned that I was pronouncing his name wrong all those years.
How do you pronounce it? Okay, so I've just been pronouncing it wrong for about 42 years then. Okay.
No, I'm assuming you're right, David.
Oh, okay. Let's assume I am. Anyway, he was playing in the old Jim Courier shirt, the stripy shirt with the green sleeves, and he went and beat Andre Agassi in the first round. And Agassi, as the reigning Wimbledon champion, went to Wimbledon and then started to play really well. He got through to the quarterfinals, and then he ran into Pete Sampras and lost in five sets, obviously. Anyway, Halle, that was 30 years ago. 30 years on, Roger Federer, who's won it how many times, Matt? Do we know?
10?
It's about 10, something like that.
10, I think.
He came back for a little knockabout and to celebrate with the tournament because he played there his whole career, barring the 1 year he played Queens and lost to Byron Black. 6-love, 6-3. Roger Federer was back in town, and they had a bit like Queens, another fantastic crowd. I mean, they really do get a great turnout there. Don't like their shadow much, but very, very much enjoyed the tennis of Alexander Bublik all week. He was absolutely brilliant. And he was combining, Matt, I feel like he was combining fun and games and what he's got to entertain you with success. I mean, that is the sweet spot.
Mm. And it's a sweet spot that he hasn't really found, certainly recently. I mean, his form in the last year or so has been really not very good. And I think when he broke through, he was the fun guy, wasn't he? And he carried that with him for quite a while. And I think he did reach a point where actually everyone was like, actually, Bublik's quite good now. And then it's really tailed off since then, and I don't think he's found that balance between, you know, underarm serves and really knuckling down and doing what's right. You know, obviously sometimes the underarm serve is right, but he's just never really got that blend right, I think, in the last year or so. And this has come out of nowhere for him to win Halle. And just as I said about Petra Kvitova, I mean, the list of players that he beat, Rublev, Zverev, Čorić, Struff, and Sinner, albeit by retirement, that's five players in a row in the top 25 that he beat there. And he had lost 15 of his last 17 matches against top 25 players. So to suddenly win five in a row is really quite wild. And honestly, it makes sense. Like, to me, Bublik should have a good record against higher ranked players because he can disrupt them. He can throw them off. It's more the weekly grind and getting out of the first or second round that I suppose is where I don't back Bublik. But to put himself in a position to play this many top players in a row and sort of gain the momentum and beat them one after the other was just so impressive. Unfortunately, he does now have the Halle curse, which is this thing that anyone who wins Halle who isn't Roger Federer loses in the first round at Wimbledon. And I mean, it's been going back years. Kohlschreiber, Meyer, Čorić, Humbert, Hurkacz, Tommy Haas. I mean, honestly, it goes back to about 2011 or something. And I would not be at all surprised if Bublik did lose in the first round of Wimbledon. I don't know how sustainable his brand of tennis is, as I've just sort of described. But when he gets it right, it's an absolute treat. He can tie top players up in knots, and I think he can make other top players think, how do you do that? Like, you're so talented. He's got such great hands, and you know, I really like seeing him play well. And it had been a tough period. I think he lost 10 matches in a row at the end of last season, the start of this season. Like, things were bad. And I think now he's up into the top 30 again. And that level-wise, that feels like where Bublik should be.
I massively enjoyed watching him walk up to the service line on match point against Alexander Zverev as if to say, your serve is nothing. So entertaining.
And win the point.
I win the point. Oh, it's so funny. Anyway, I'll look forward to seeing. I'd love Bublik to be Bublik at Wimbledon and have a run. You know, I just feel like the crowds would love it. And so, yeah, let's see if he can. Talking of players you want to see remind you about who they used to be, we got to see Venus Williams over the last week in Birmingham. And it was joyous. It was truly joyous. She beat Camilla Giorgi in a match of more than 3 hours. I watched all of the last sort of hour and a half of that. It was magnetic stuff. And I mean, it was, she had a nasty fall in the first set. She was kind of a nasty fall, which Camilla Giorgi then sort of punctuated with a fist pump and a come on when 43-year-old Venus Williams is sprawling on the ground at the far end of the court. Goodness knows how injured. Well, fortunately, she wasn't badly injured. She came back and beat her. And eventually lost to Yelena Ostapenko in the next round. But just, there was enough there, Matt, to just remind you, well, how good she was. But also, I mean, it's just an amazing story. She's still so in love with the sport. She's so much still wants to do it, that she's going up to Birmingham where it's raining half the time. And I know that because I'm here and it's raining. And and she could be anywhere else in the world and she wants to be there doing what she does.
Mm. Oh, it was so magical. It was so special. I was watching the closing stage of that match on my phone as I was going into London, that I was just so engrossed in it. I completely forgot to tap in at the station and have incurred retrospective charges, but they were totally worth it for following Venus Williams. And honestly, I think just what you've said, her grit in that match was extraordinary. You know, if I had to imagine a scenario which was sort of the least likely way for 43-year-old injured Venus Williams to win a tennis match, it would be after 3 and a bit hours. It was just so improbable that she would find a way to win that match. And yet, because of that grit and that just unmatched seemingly love for the sport that she has, and the desire to just keep showing up and doing what she can do and backing herself, you know, she backs herself. She says, I am Venus Williams and I can win this tennis match. And she's been doing it for almost 30 years as a professional, and it's so, so special. And a great interview she gave afterwards where she said that she was surprised that Camilla Giorgi wasn't number one in the world because of the level that she was playing, and she was so pleased with herself that she'd found her big serve after all this time. Said, I hit some today that were up at 120, and yeah, that was a real actual great point of her game in this match was her serve. You know, she's changed that motion over the years, and you know, it was working against Giorgi. And then, you know, she nearly, a couple of days later, backed it up and almost beat Yelena Ostapenko. You know, she took that one into a third set as well and was a break up in that third set. And for her to be running players who, you know, are winning titles and are threats to go deep in slams, for her to be doing that off so little tennis, I just think speaks to how incredibly special and how incredibly good she is. And yeah, I was thrilled to see that she did get one of the Wimbledon wildcards. It obviously would have been absolutely shocking had she not. But I just hope she gets a centre court moment that she deserves at Wimbledon.
Is Catherine Yelena Ostapenko in the mix for Wimbledon? I mean, she's just gone and beaten Barbora Krejcikova. She's managed to find a way past Venus Williams, despite things going off the ball a bit. I know you've got your history with Ostapenko. I know you've got a massive soft spot for her, but she did let you down terribly at the French Open. So where do you...
What a horrible question, David.
Well, yeah, you put me in charge and that's what you get.
I would be surprised if Yelena Ostapenko won Wimbledon. I wouldn't be surprised to see her in a semi-final.
Mm. Okay, that's fair.
I wouldn't be surprised as I would if a lot of other players won Wimbledon.
I suppose that
if she's in a sub-mix, but I would be surprised.
But then if she got through to the semi-final, she'd be in the mix for the title, wouldn't she? That's the difficult bit. Can she get to the semis?
Oh. Ask Matt. Ask Matt these difficult questions.
Oh, thanks. A sort of difficult question relay that we're having. Mm. I think you've put that very well. I think I would be surprised if Ostapenko won Wimbledon. What impressed me about her this week was similar to what I just said. I don't always think of Ostapenko as winning really close matches. I mean, she actually has got quite a good three-set record. And she won, four three-set matches to get to the final and then squeezed through that second set against Krejcikova. And, actually both sets were tight against Krejcikova, weren't they? It looked like she was going to win it easily and then Krejcikova mounted this comeback and Ostapenko fended her off. There is a grit to Ostapenko as well, which I think sometimes gets a bit lost amid all the incredibly flat ground strokes and all the eye rolling at line sass. Calls going against her way and all the sass, you know, there is also a Grand Slam champion in there. But I would be surprised, and I still think, I know she has won a slam with that second serve. I just think it's very difficult to win a slam with that second serve. Eventually someone is just going to sort of take over, I think, on return. And that's the part of the game that always makes me really worried about Ostapenko. But she's another one that I want to see do well at Wimbledon because, she's great. Her brand of tennis is great.
She would definitely elevate proceedings in the second week if she's in it. Mm. There's no question about that. And as things stand, I mean, I don't know whether anything's changed here, but we've got Petra Kvitova against Yelena Ostapenko down for round one in Eastbourne.
As it stands, I've just looked that up. Nobody's withdrawn yet.
Wow.
So...
Okay. We look forward to seeing what happens with that. We've also got Jessica Pegula against Zheng Qinwen in round one. And Zheng is working with Wim Fossette now, who's worked with so many of the top players over the years. Elena Rybakina, as Catherine was saying, has withdrawn from Eastbourne with this viral illness. That's just such a blow. I did see the match she played against Donna Vekic, who was excellent the other day. So I don't want to read too much into it and put it down to the illness, but the fact that she's now withdrawn from this, I mean, it suggests that she's not quite right. I mean, she didn't look quite right in that match. She was hitting a lot of errors. She looked pretty washed out, really. I think she'd be most people's favourite, really, wouldn't she, Catherine? I think she would be the favourite, I think, going into Wimbledon if she was fully fit and everything.
I think so, yeah. I mean, obviously, we'd be looking at how she was playing in the warm-up tournaments if she were fit. I think she would be. All other things being equal, Rybakina would be the favourite. And I don't know. It feels if she's this far off being right 3 weeks on from the virus, that doesn't scream you're definitely going to be fine another 1 week on.
No.
From that, I think it's a big worry.
Yeah, it is. Breaking news, I've just had a text from Pam Shriver asking me whether I get any points for runner-up position for Donna Vekic.
No,
I don't, Pam. And I blame you for that. So anyway, thank you for the memories of the run to the final. I enjoyed it while it lasted. Other players that are going to be in Eastbourne, Beatrice Haddad Meyer. Oh God, it's not getting any better, is it, for my predictions, talking about Donovicic's defeat. And now Beatrice Haddad Meyer reminding me of her incredible form this time last year, which made me pick her for Wimbledon. Then she lost in the first round. Katie Bolter, Coco Gauff, Anse Jabeur, Daria Kasatkina are all in the draw, so it's going to be a fantastic week in Eastbourne. There's the tournament as well that Iga Swiatek's playing in Bad Homburg in the WTA 250 there. She's the top seed, Iga Swiatek, with Bianca Andreescu, Donna Vekic, Ludmila Samsonova, Leda Fernandez all in the draw. And men's tournaments are the ATP 250 in Eastbourne. Taylor Fritz is the top seed and defending champion. Stefanos Tsitsipas is in Mallorca. He's the top seed defending champion there. They've also got Ben Shelton, Alexander Bublik, and Alejandro Davidovich Fokina. And I'm afraid we're going to have to finish on some more crap news, folks. And that is the news that Annette Kontaveit is retiring after Wimbledon. She's only 27 years old. She was the world number two last year. I mean, you know, this is a player who just seemed to have cracked it, figured out tennis, figured out how to get the very best out of her game and to compete at the highest level. She had that incredible winning streak that went into the WTA finals, didn't she? And she got to the final there. But she's suffered from lumbar disc degeneration, a back condition which doesn't allow for full-scale training or continued competition. And, I mean, Catherine, I know you know a bit about that condition, and I'm just gutted for her.
Yeah, not to make it about me, but I have lumbar disc degeneration, and I can understand why Annette Kontaveit is unable to continue being professional athlete. I really desperately feel for her, because there's nothing that can be done about it. You can manage it, but it's degeneration. There is currently no way of improving the health of your discs. I am reassured by medical professionals that stem cell research is coming along very quickly.
They're working on it.
I've been assured that they're working on it, just for me and Annette. But probably not soon enough for Annette Kontaveit's career. My advice, Annette, would be get yourself a Peloton bike, because that's been the biggest revelation for me since my diagnosis. And having said it's not about me, I have just talked about me. But I'm very sad for her.
Mm. Yeah, Peloton bike and a dog and a podcast. Those are all good things.
Yeah, there's lots of fun physical activity you can do. You can't win top level tennis matches. And lucky for me, I was never winning top level tennis matches, so I'm fine. Mm.
Anyway, feel for you, Annette, and, well, wish you all the best in whatever you go into in the future. A couple of other things before we meet our two lovely mascots, Snicker and Doodle, little tease there. We've got our two Friends shows this week. In fact, one was recorded last week, which was the Netflix Breakpoint Review Part 2 episodes. What is it, 6 to 10, which I have to be honest, I haven't watched any of those, and I haven't listened to your show yet either, Catherine and Matt. But I very much plan to do both of those things this week, because I am too a friend of the Tennis Podcast. Even does that work? Well, I can get access to it. And and then later this week, in fact, on Wednesday, we are recording our Tennis Relived edition for Wimbledon, which is focusing on the life and career of Fred Perry. So we are really excited about being able to delve into his past, and Matt's been reading all about him, and we've got audio archive from Fred himself, actually, which the BBC Radio has been able to provide us with. And we've got a couple of interviews as well from people who knew Fred and will be able to tell us all about him. So can't wait to delve into that. That'll be on Wednesday. So if you're not already a friend of the Tennis Podcast, become one and you'll get access to all this extra stuff. Right then, Snicker and Doodle, owned by Amy Tarr. They are 5-year-old Maltese Shih Tzus and they are brother and sister. Their favourite activity besides watching tennis is hanging out in Central Park with their posse of doggy pals, and their favourite tennis players are Iga Świątek and Carlos Alcaraz. Catherine, what do they look like?
Well, that ages them, doesn't it? That helps you pinpoint their age, I mean, by who their favourite tennis players are. They look like Maltese Shih Tzu crosses. David, this is what they look like. Very
shaggy
characterful,
characterful
faces. Very good at posing would be my main feedback. Getting two dogs to look at the camera and pose obediently in the same photo at the same time. Very impressive. So well done, Snicker and Doodle. They are lovely. I'm really missing Billie Jean at the moment. She's with my mum and dad. So that's making me crave doggy cuddles even more than I am doing.
Mm. Oh. Well, they're lovely, and we are delighted to have them as our mascots. And you'll be able to see a picture of them in our next newsletter. So thank you to Snicker and Doodle for being our mascots this week. I have got my own mascot, Maisie, and we were so close, Maisie. I am so upset. Sorry. Catherine's got Xenia. Catherine was also quite close with Sebastian Corda until he...
let down by Seb Corda.
Got some unspecified injury that threw everything into the air. Matt's got Darwin, who, and Matt was nowhere near success this week, were you, Matt?
Mine was the only prediction that didn't lose. Retired.
Oh. We're playing that game, are we?
Do I get any points for that, Pam?
No, Yannick Sinner has let you down. Billie Jean the dog, whilst also being at Catherine's parents' house, is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. Our top folks and executive producers are Jamie, Hannah and Drew. Thank you all. And we have shout-outs, Matt.
We have Michelle Dean in Newport Beach, California.
Wow. Michelle, have we got any Michelle tennis players? I can't think of any.
Marcha de Brito.
Oh, very good. Very good. She's long since retired, but still, she counts. Well done, Matt Roberts. Michelle, thank you very much for being a friend of the tennis podcast.
But both of us.
All right, Catherine, sorry. Quite right. I didn't know it, so you can both have brownie points for that. Matt, who else we got?
We have Jessica Thompson in Melbourne.
All right, Jessica, like Pagula.
Hello, Jessica.
Yes, David's got in there.
And Jordan Thompson, the love child of Jessica Pagula and Jordan Thompson.
Yeah, maybe. Amazing. Thank you so much for being our friend. And she's from Melbourne, you say, Matt?
Yes.
We like Melbourne.
I wonder what Melbourne's like at this time of year. Less good. Okay, we'll see you in 6 months. When it's good again. And finally, Matt.
Finally, we have Angela Link.
Right, Angela.
Angela is from St.
Like
Louis.
Like Angela Mortimer.
Yes.
St. Louis, Missouri.
Yes, which is where Tim Ream is from.
Oh.
But yeah, back to Angela Mortimer.
He's a footballer, right?
Yes, he's a legend.
Yeah, okay. Angela Mortimer, a Wimbledon champion who beat Christine Truman in the final.
Yes.
More than 60 years ago now.
1961?
I think so, yeah.
And married to John Barrett.
Yeah, former player and brilliant BBC commentator for many decades. So, yeah, well done, Matt, again. And well done, Catherine. You also got her. I keep doing this. Angela.
Out of history here at the end of the show. Thank you, Angela.
Yeah, thank you for being friends of the Tennis Podcast at shout-out level. If you would like us to come up with some strange reference points for your name, you can be a friend of the Tennis Podcast at shout-out level as well. Just go to the link in our show notes. Not only do you get that unmissable experience, you also get access.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
As to, I think we've produced about 12, 13, something like that, podcasts this year, just for Friends of the Tennis Podcast. We're about another 20-odd last year. So they're all waiting for you. We've got Fred Perry coming later this week, and many more beyond this point in the calendar as well. We've got loads more coming your way. But we've got Wimbledon to look forward to first. That will start for us on Friday with the draw show, with our first live stream from Wimbledon. Bring it on.